all through winter. If you order a meal deal online or in person, Monday to Friday, you'll get a corn fritter for free. All you need to do is order a meal deal via the link on the Raglan Fish Facebook page or head on down to the wharf at the end of Wallace Street to make your order. See you at the wharf.
Are you too busy to do your garden or lawns? Maybe you need some help or you just can't be bothered. Waitere Property Maintenance is here to help. Here's Craig to give you the full list of services.
Lawns, rubbish removal, gardens, gutter cleaning, edges, water blasting, hedges, tree removal, window cleaning, grass seeding, small excavations, topsoiling and weed spraying.
Waitere Property Maintenance, we're your local do-anything-outside solution for residential properties. Check us out on Facebook or give Adrian a call on 021 657 354.
If you have ever thought about volunteering, now is a great time to contact Volunteering Waikato. Their website makes it easier than ever before to find the right opportunity in your town. Get involved in your community, boost your CV, meet new people and learn new skills. For more information, go to volunteeringwaikato.org.nz. Volunteering Waikato, enriching lives.
This is not the BBC.
Which way is west? 'Cause I need a new address. 'Cause my house is under siege.
Thank you. Good evening, Whangara and Raglan. Hope you find it reassuring. It's not the BBC. You're listening to Raglan talking to Raglan on Raglan Community Radio, Rangio Whangara, at 6 minutes. Well, just coming up 7 minutes past six. So see what we can fit into the next hour and 25 minutes or so. And let's have a look, first of all, at what the weather's doing. So the weather's going to be on the wettish side. It's not surprising. Current temperature around about 13. Going down slightly all tonight, but not all that much. Lowest temperature will be in a couple of nights' time, which is only down to 8. It's not going to be that cold tonight. Highest temperature in the next few days will be 17. So we are heading into spring. Pressure's low, though, 1,012 hectopascals, which makes it not surprising that we're going to get about 4 millimetres of rain tomorrow. Going to carry on raining on Thursday, maybe up to 10 millimetres on Thursday, and then ease off on Friday, probably. Only Friday morning with a couple of millimetres then, and then should be a dry weekend, which makes a change. The next, just puzzling over why I've written 10 to 2 there, might come back to me. At the moment, it's mystery. So anyway, predicting a westerly of 25 knots tonight, maybe getting up to 30 knots tomorrow. Not much sign of it so far, but it'll be later on this evening. A westerly swell of 2 metres, so unusual to get westerly winds and westerly swell. Usually the prevailing wind and swell is from the southwest rather than west. The next low tide is 20 past 10 this evening, 1 metre low tide, so not very low, not very high tide. For the next high tide we'll see tomorrow, which will be about 5:30 tomorrow afternoon, a 2.7 metre tide, so a metre or so lower than they sometimes get. Days, of course, still getting longer. So we've got 9 minutes more of the morning with a possible sunrise at 6:45. And we've got 6 minutes more of the evening with 3 minutes to six for a sunset, so only 12 minutes ago, which is why it's not dark yet completely. Looking at what's coming up this week, we've got the usual things happening. Have a look at our website, raglanradio.com, for the usual list of things. And there's also all the other things happening, which are starting off with the Raglan Ramblers going rambling tomorrow. So that's something they do every week, but different place each week. This week it's going to Winery Reserve. So for a change, it's going to be a fairly local walk. Not sure what the weather's going to do. And Winery Reserve can be muddy when it's wet. So not sure how muddy it's going to be. Relatively short walk, just a morning walk. So that's happening usual time and place for the Raglan Ramblers, which is 9 o'clock at the or in James Street, rather. That will be down near the Catholic Church. So that's happening tomorrow morning. Then moving on to tomorrow afternoon, we've got the Community House Annual General Meeting. That's happening at 6 o'clock in down in their basement, I think it is. Then 7 o'clock, there's a film at the old school, Where Olive Trees Weep. It's about Palestine struggles and resilience under occupation. We'll hear a bit more about that soon, because Aaron did a good interview on it. Was it yesterday, I think? Then don't know of anything particular happening on Thursday, Friday. There's the monthly meeting of Time Bank Group having coffee at Orca at 10:30. Orca Cafe down the corner of Bow Street and Cliff Street. And Saturday, a couple of films on at the old school. One of them is called Bookworm, which they've shown a couple of weeks ago, about an American magician and his daughter who go in search of a mythical black panther somewhere in this country, not quite sure where. It's mythical anyway. And so that's on at 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and 7:30 Saturday evening. We've got a new film called Sitting Duck, which is about a French whistleblower, a union rep in a nuclear power station. And apparently whistleblowing's not too safe in France. It's supposed to be based on a true story, and apparently she got attacked as a result of it. So it describes itself as a mystery thriller. So I'm not quite sure how much, but based on truth. So a bit disturbing to hear things like that. Whistleblowers, you hope, get protected, but quite often whistleblowers, the Julian Assange is one of the main examples, end up in prison for years and years. So whistleblowing should be good, but whistleblowing isn't appreciated in many countries of the world, unfortunately. So that's the film, which is on Saturday evening at, say, 7:30 at the old school on Stewart Street. And there's another film they're showing, which they've shown. No, this is a new one as well, is on at 4:30 on Sunday, called Ghostlight. It's about a guy who gets involved in a local live theatre, and he's also grieving a family tragedy, and it helps to make sense of the family tragedy and being involved in live theatre. So, called Ghostlight, on at 4:30 at the old school on Stewart Street on Sunday afternoon. And last thing I've got down for this week is Tuesday. Environment Centre does things to do with gardening on Tuesday afternoon. So this week it's doing seed sorting on Tuesday. So that's almost a week from now, at the Environment Centre in the Town Hall on Bow Street. So that's the fairly brief list of things that I've spotted which are on this week. As I say, there's the usual list of things on our website. Look for the events page on raglanradio.com. There's not that much in the news again this week. Aaron and I were speculating as to why there's so little happening at the councils, or so little that we're being told about. So I think Waikato District Council is focused on trying to sort out the north of district. So they've got some things happening there. Of course, there's the ongoing consultation. We've still got a week or two to get ideas into them on what ought to happen to our parks, reserves, libraries, public halls, things like that. So have a look at their website. Have a look up at the top, the tab which says Say It. And if you click on that, you'll find that there's consultation about things happening in the far north of the district and consultation about this district-wide thing of what we ought to do with our parks and libraries and whatnot. There's also, they've been talking for a long time about the boat ramp at the wharf and how it was getting into bad repair. They've now got round to repairing it. So the news release says work was completed during the past week on laying a new concrete surface on the wharf boat ramp. Contractors closed half the ramp to allow the works to happen safely and for the concrete to set. Next week, they'll be swapping sides and laying the other strip. And the boat ramp will be open throughout and the work will be complete in October. Sad bit of news is that Strait Aid Whangaroa was closed. In March, Trade Aid announced that it would progressively shut its shops. Not sure whether progressive is the right word for that, but anyway, gradually shutting them. I think Trade Aid Whangaroa is one of the last. They've been having a clearing warehouse, their warehouse, with a 70% off sale. And there's a bit of history saying it began as Waka Huia, started by Eva Rickard in the building now used by Raglan Surf on Wainui Road. When Trade Aid expanded, Waka Huia transformed into Trade Aid Whangaroa and moved to Bow Street. And it was one of the most successful Trade Aid shops run by volunteers and a part-time manager. Like many other retail businesses, they faced a challenging environment in the last 2 years. Cost of living has led to rising costs and diminishing sales. And through focusing on importing, wholesaling and selling online, they hope to remain committed to improving producers' and farmers' lives with a fair income, a way out of poverty, and raising Kiwis' awareness of fair trade. It'd be harder to do those things without a chain of shops, but hopefully it will continue. They have still got some of their products in the supermarkets, and as it says, you can find Trade Aid online as well. And the other story I've spotted is Raglan Horday Park wins Garden Award. It seems to have got covered both by the District Council, Raglan 23, and even one of the government departments has it on their website. So the Raglan 23 version reads, the team at Raglan Holiday Park, Papahua, have returned home from the Holiday Parks Conference and Trade Exhibition as champions after winning their Sustainable Innovation Award for their community garden. A few years ago, park staff started Papahua Mara Kai Community Garden, a place to grow or a place to plant, and Mara Kai, a food garden. Camp manager Leanne Nielsen said, Papahua Mara Kai is one of many of our initiatives which makes the park one of the most popular destinations in the district. The permaculture garden used bokashi, which is a Japanese method of composting food waste, and 2 years ago, the garden was revitalized with fish waste layered with cardboard, soil and mulch. Seeds are from the Environment Centre's seed bank, which I mentioned they've got that sorting to do on Tuesday, promoting seed sharing. And an on-site worm farm produces fertiliser for the garden. The garden provides fresh organics to visitors with surplus donated to the food pantry. And staff encourage visiting children to learn gardening and sustainability. The judges said this innovation has so many benefits in terms of education, visitor satisfaction, lowering waste and carbon footprint, and community impact. It's a shining example of a tourism business that has truly embedded sustainability to the benefit of the business visitors and the community and environment. So there's always glowing things that go with these. I'm not quite sure how true they are. It's good that they have got a garden and that they are encouraging people to use permaculture. But the only other news that I've spotted is that I've been looking at the COVID figures and they look like good news this week. Number of hospital cases and reported cases is, I think, lowest this year. So down to 92 cases reported across the Waikato, down to 5 in Waikato hospitals. Number of dying, though, unfortunately, remains the same as it has been for a week or two, at 3. But 3 out of all people in Waikato dying with COVID. Is probably as good as we're going to get for a while. I think it's only been a few occasions this year when it's been down to less than 3 people a week dying of COVID. Hopefully. Anyway, that's the news which I've spotted this week. It's now 21 minutes past 6. I think probably I have the bottom of the hour items before we go on and listen to that bit of news about the film that's being shown, Gillian talking about the Palestine film where olive trees weep. And if I press bottom of the hour items, it's not bottom of the hour items anymore, changed it to half hour ad rotation, still the same thing anyway. So yeah, let's listen to this, and we'll listen to Gillian, then we'll listen to Oliver talking about the Georgie book that he's done on Carrioi. Quite an impressive piece of work, and probably an even more impressive map. But anyway, we'll be hearing about those, so let's see how we go on. Here's Bottom of the Hour.
Step Into Your Power by Ray LaMontagne. And I think that's going to be a little bit of a theme song for Heart Talks, because it really epitomises what it's all about, which is bringing your heart to the world, doing you, being true to yourself, and doing what you love. So yeah, it's about stepping into your own power. So yeah, and today we're going to talk about equanimity. I just was working with a client this morning, and we were talking about creating and the art of creating. How do we do that? How do we get that vision in our heads and then make it happen in our life? So yeah, and we came to the conclusion that equanimity is a big part of it.
And let's listen to Gillian talking about this Palestine film that's coming up tomorrow evening.
Hey, listening to The Morning Show here on Raglan Community Radio. And in the studio, I've got Gillian Marie. Good morning.
Good morning, Aaron. Kia ora.
So,
kia ora to your listeners.
Yeah, there's a movie on this Wednesday that you're part of organising called Where Olive Trees Weep. It's a documentary about Palestine.
Yes.
And I guess the
made
key...
Made by Palestinians. And it was released before... October the 7th event.
Yeah, I thought that was important to mention. Yep. That. So, for some people, I mean, what's happening over there at the moment is such a big deal that I think some people have become aware of the situation that may not have been aware of it before then.
Oh, absolutely.
So, but this movie will so therefore be giving some background.
Yeah, give context for what's happening. And I think helps to understand the desperateness of the actions that happened on October the 7th that have started the terrible massacre that's going on in Gaza right now by Israel.
Yeah.
Desperate people do desperate things, and the people of Gaza and West Bank have been desperate for a long, long time.
Yeah, I'm worried that all the people who are just the people on the ground and either side of the wall are feeling desperate these days.
Absolutely. I mean, 70% of the people who've died in Gaza, and stats are over 42,000 now, and that's just people who've been registered as dead.
Yeah.
70% of them are women and children. So that's not even counting the men who are non-combatants as well.
So let's go into the movie first, and then we'll talk a bit more about that. So it is this Wednesday at the Old School at 7.
Yes.
Just tell us you know about it. Tell us about it.
I haven't been able to view it yet because it's still on its way here.
Okay, right.
through the vapour. But I understand from reviews and from other people who've seen it and they showed it on Waiheke a couple of weeks ago that it's a very moving film, and it does contain that context of the Palestinian situation since the creation of Israel in 1948 and the Nakba that happened, the evacuation of more than 150,000 Palestinians from their land. That was the first.
What does the word Nakba mean? Because we hear
means,
that.
It means forced removal.
Right.
So over 150,000 Palestinians were removed from their land. They thought they were only going away for a few days. They were forced out by the Israelis.
Oh, so they were tricked. It's easier to trick people to leave than to go in with guns.
And they're just horrific stories of that period, and those families have never gone back. So some of them went to Jordan, some went to Australia, they went all around the world, the United States, and those families are, they still consider themselves Palestinians. But they were forced off their land. So right from the beginning, Israel has had a policy of removing Palestinians or trying to convince the world that Palestinians didn't exist, haven't exist, don't exist, right from 1948.
So this documentary, you said to me off the air that it's made by Palestinian people?
Yes.
And does it talk about the history or is it talking about life there in current day?
It talks about the resilience of the people under Israeli occupation. Mm. They are a resilient people, but they have been colonised, and so it's about life for them with their removal from their land.
I think one of the things about it is they haven't been successfully fully colonised. Like, if you look at like what's happened in this country, there were terrible things that happened to Maori people, probably in a similar way to what's happening in Gaza.
Exactly,
in Gaza
colonial
at the moment.
Struggle.
Yeah, but then the process of colonisation kind of finished, you know, and then we were just left, and things became more peaceful, and then we moved into this period of trying to right the wrongs. But it feels like
a lot of Maori would disagree with you and say that colonisation continued in different forms.
Yeah, I'm not saying that that hasn't happened, but this is at the sharp end. Let's say that over there, what's happening is the sharp end of the colonisation process at the moment.
Absolutely,
and there's a lot of resistance, maybe the fact that the world's eyes are on that situation, which with the power of modern media, compared to 100 years ago where there wasn't that, things were a lot more secret and in the dark. Probably is quite significant.
I think this war, it is more visible, and it's really interesting that Israeli soldiers are actually spreading a lot of the atrocities that they are committing in Gaza on their social media pages. So they have no sense that there's going to be any.
That means they're kind of proud of what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, which is terrifying to me, because if soldiers do that to people who are trapped in an open prison, which is what Gaza is, it's walled, totally controlled, its borders.
How many square k's in Gaza?
It's
What's it comparable to? Just give us a feel.
Its landmass is smaller than Wellington. And it's okay. A third of the size of Auckland, and yet it, before October the 3rd, it had 2.3 million people.
So if you put a wall around South Auckland, for instance, or put a wall around the North Shore, you'd probably get...
And they bombed, Israel bombed the airport, so they've never had any air access. And they controlled the waterways from the Mediterranean. The Israeli government controls it. Yeah. So the only border where there was any coming and going really was with Egypt, and that's now totally controlled by the Philadelphia corridor, it's called, between Gaza and Egypt at Rafah. And Arish is on the Egyptian side of that border. That's now totally controlled by the Israeli army. So Israel is controlling absolutely everything that gets in, which is one of the reasons for the starvation, the lack of food, lack of medicines, and the lack of water.
And this is what it was like before the current event started.
The Israeli control of the border has happened since October 7th.
Oh, so that was the border to Egypt?
With Egypt, yeah.
Okay.
But Egypt kept that border pretty tightly controlled.
So there wasn't...
It wasn't free ability to come and go.
So that description of the Gaza Strip as an open-air prison, I've heard well before October.
Yeah. So Israel has controlled access and people coming and going. I mean, everyone has seen the cattle, almost like the way we would put cattle on a truck, the way people are shuffled through if they're working in Israel and if they have permission to work in Israel through all of the checkpoints. I went to Palestine and I was just, and this was in the 1990s, and I was just really amazed at the checkpoints that people had to go through, Palestinians had to go through to get anywhere. Between villages, even within the West Bank itself.
Very much an occupied
territory. It was totally occupied,
So when you've been a supporter of the cause, I guess, is one way of putting it, for a long time, like when did you first discover the situation?
Well, I was raised in the 1950s in New Zealand, and so we heard a lot about how Israel was making a desert flower and they were creating a state from a place where there were no people. So I was really shocked when I met a Palestinian when I was studying in Sydney, whose family had been removed from from Palestine territory during the Nakba in 1948 at the creation of Israel. And his family had moved to Lebanon. They'd had no choice but to move to Lebanon. And he was born in Lebanon, and then they moved to Sydney. And so we became friends, and he filled me in on what was happening. So the propaganda, and it was propaganda that we had been... I remember being taken to movies at Huntley. I went to Huntley College. To a movie there about the Holocaust and about how Israel was being created from the people.
The curly part of it is that the Holocaust was an appalling thing that really did happen.
Exactly.
And some kind of, I don't know, something needed to be done about that. But somehow it's turned into this other thing. The idea of a place where Jews could be safe is, of course, that's a good idea. But it's not. It's turned into something else. And I don't think many people in Israel right now feel very safe.
I don't think many people in, because their propaganda is so powerful. Most Israelis have never met Palestinians.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing I too want to say about war, it's a rule of war that propaganda is. The governments are always doing lots of propaganda to their own populations during any war, anywhere. There's always it's wall to wall propaganda. So we should just expect that. It's not a controversial thing to state that there's propaganda.
No, but it's not just in war. It's right, the propaganda goes right through through the education system all the way through, and when they are recruited into the Israeli army as well, it continues.
Of course, an army has to have propaganda, otherwise its soldiers aren't going to go and fight.
Yeah, and the language that's used again about Palestinians is that they're not human, And that's part of the reason why I'm still active in the struggle, is that I feel that it's a really just struggle, and I always have done.
So that was the 70s you were in university.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was during the Vietnam War, right? So we were very preoccupied with stopping the Vietnam War at that time. That was our Palestine genocide, really.
That's, I mean, it's a long time to be fighting for a cause and not having a lot of – do you feel like there's not been any success? Has there been successes on the way?
I think there has been a shift with the devastation and with the death toll that's happening right now.
Yeah.
But my concern is the world attention is very short.
Yeah.
And that when there is finally a ceasefire, then Palestine will again go under the radar. That's why I think it's really important that people become informed about it. And as citizens of Aotearoa, we have a responsibility to make sure our voice is heard in the international in the international forums around Palestine and this, I mean, 90% of Palestinians have been displaced from their homes. And some of them have been moved 8 or 9 times in this war. So, and I just, one of the things that keeps me awake at night is the trauma that, that the children have experienced. They've been bombed for 10 months now, you know, and little kids now who've lost both parents, they've lost their whole families.
Even if there was a ceasefire today and genuine peace broke out, we're still talking about another generation before, a couple of generations before the effects of the war really start, really dissipate.
Because I think it'll be even more than that, really. Yeah. I mean, people still talk about the impact of colonialism on Maori families.
Mm.
And you know, we've just had the abuse and care report come out, right? And so... Unless there is a really international and united effort to rebuild Palestine and rebuild it for Palestinians and not for Israelis. That's the fear that I have, is that the Palestinians will again, there'll be another Nakba and the remaining Palestinians will be evacuated.
It feels like there is now.
Yeah,
I mean, I think they can't move.
They can't go anywhere, right?
From what I've seen, in some ways I try not to watch, but from what I've seen, it feels like the Israeli leadership is somewhat unhinged at this point. It's not. They're making decisions that sane people wouldn't, or people who, or I guess if you've othered the Palestinians from their point of view. They're subhuman or not human, then I guess all sorts of things become possible. But even that, we don't go and kill dogs willy-nilly like that. Like, there's more to it than just that.
I think Israel's sowing its seeds of its own destruction.
That is actually what I'm quite worried about.
Mm.
Like, because we'd I know at least one person in Israel who was here in Raglan, and I can see from their Facebook feed the propaganda that they're getting through Facebook is just really wild.
Yeah.
Quite makes my eyes stand out on stalks. But I fear for him and his family, because with the attitudes that are coming, these kind of apocalyptic attitudes, I don't see how it can end well. And do they not have designs on outside of the current Israeli borders as well, thinking that that should also be part of the Jewish homeland?
Yes, I do. I understand that land in Gaza is already for sale in Israel.
But also beyond, because there's I'm thinking mentally the map of Israel, and there's the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but outside of that as well.
Oh yeah, they'd like to get back to the sewers as well, and you know the sewers and the Sinai territory in Egypt.
The Egyptians might have something to say about that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did in the 1967 war.
Okay. Well, we're not going to solve that here.
But the movie, if people are, I think it's really – I know I've talked with people and they say, oh, it's so far away and it's so bad, I just don't want to know about it. But I think it's in our common humanity to actually do something about it. And we can do things. We can boycott Israel the same way that we boycotted South Africa. Mm,
and that was successful.
That was successful, yes. So there, and it is being successful. In the Middle East, like Turkey now has just blocked Coca-Cola going in there.
Right.
McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken are being boycotted in the Middle East and by Indonesia as well. And that's having an immense impact on those companies. And SodaStream has been here in New Zealand as one of the products that comes from Israel, from the occupied territory that is being boycotted here. So I think you can have a look at the labels on what you're buying and not buy from Israel, not buy from countries that are providing the military wherewithal for the Israelis.
Well, that's another important thing too, isn't it? Yeah. The US is spending billions of dollars. It has always spent.
And Germany and UK, they're supplying Israel with military hardware.
Is there a website or something where there's a list of these places,
yeah,
like a boycott
if
thing?
They go through to Palestine Solidarity, which is an organisation that John Minto has been involved in for years and years and years, and it has all kinds of ways in which you can be involved in support for Palestine and find out about, where rallies are happening and what events are happening.
Yeah. I do think that thing of putting pressure on, like, the big corporates, because they've got the power, they can pick up the phone to the White House and say, hey, I want to talk, and they'll get listened to.
And Starbucks is another one, The CEO has funneled an incredible amount of money into the Israeli-occupied, with the territories that Israel has occupied on the West Bank.
Right. Mm, okay.
And all of these boycotts are having an impact, as they did in South Africa. And there's an academic boycott also against Israel academics, and that's having an impact as well. So that kind of isolation, and that's where we need to put pressure on our own government ministers to also be part of that international. We're on the wrong side of history on this one as a country.
Yeah, like all our governments have been.
All the governments in the West have been, yeah.
But regardless of whether it's National or Labour leading the coalition.
Labour was a little more, but the Greens and Te Pāti Māori have been the ones who've been supportive of the Palestinian cause.
Usually the Labour Party will wring their hands but actually do nothing constructive. That's kind of what I expect these days. They look like they care, but they didn't really.
Yeah, well, they
do much.
So we can put pressure on our own MP, but also on Minister of Foreign Affairs, and also we took in a lot of people from Ukraine and to live here in New Zealand, but there has been no equivalent program for people with Palestinians living in New Zealand to have their family members be allowed to come here. They haven't been allowed to get visas to come here. So that's another place where we can put pressure on. And one area that I think that we can also put pressure on is that young Israelis are allowed to come here with a 2-year free visa to work.
Yeah.
A lot of those young Israelis have been in the Israeli army and have committed atrocities in Gaza now. Do we want those young people in our country right now?
Well, if you're looking at a South Africa style isolation program boycott, then certainly that question has to be part of it, doesn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, and there's also a thing for investors. There's a program out there as well.
Yes.
And that includes our KiwiSaver, so we're all kind of investors.
Yes, and superannuates as well. Some of the superannuation fee was also, I think that has now been divested.
Out of Israeli companies.
Out of Israeli companies. But even the University of Victoria, where I was recently, some of their money was invested in is through their companies that they invest in.
Which you would expect normally, like the whole investment thing, it's just like a spider's web across the world. So some of it is going to end up in Israel. So that is.
Unless you're in invest ethically, you can do that.
Yeah, the ethical investment. Yep. There's an ethical KiwiSaver.
Yep, yes.
And there's all those options are out there.
Yes, there are. You have to do a bit of digging because they're not right up front. But and the other thing is I think people need to be aware of where they're getting their source material about what's going on in Gaza.
This is so hard.
Search it out. Well, Al Jazeera is a pretty good source for what's happening, even though their journalists are not allowed by Israel to be in Gaza or the West Bank. What they've done is they're using local people. So you have local people who are telling what's going on there.
There's a journalist, a woman, she's probably in her 30s, who's been to the West Bank, and she talked about watching the settlers there raiding, like these are civilian people raiding Palestinian homes and just kicking them out.
Yeah. And burning them. Houses have been burnt and burnt alive.
I mean, this is the stuff that makes your hair stand on end, that's considered normal.
Yep.
That's okay to do that.
Yes.
And so somehow she got into the West Bank and was able to observe that. I can't remember her name. It'll come back to me later. But she's the kind of journalist who's the one who goes to the places and actually sees it with her own eyes to report back.
Yes.
So it is happening a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Her name will come back to me later. I promise I'll let people know if I can.
Yeah, it is. It's because Israel has prevented international journalists from going into Gaza or the West Bank.
Of course, if there's atrocities happening, they're going to do that, aren't they?
No.
So anyway, the film.
Film is on at 7 o'clock.
Wednesday night,
$10 donation, cash at the door only.
Yep. Or you can donate more if you want.
And you can donate more and it'll go for medical aid to Gaza.
Okay, and so that's, at the old school, 7 o'clock, and it's called Where Olive Trees Weep, and people could probably find trailers for that online, I imagine.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and it's a documentary about a bit about the history and current situation.
No.
Current up to the 7th of October.
Before that, yeah.
Yeah. Is it 7th of October? Was that the date?
Yes, it was. Yeah,
so it was before that. So if you've just, with the current atrocities, discovered what's happening over there, there's a whole story leading up to that as well. That will fill you in, and it's not a story that is getting told in our national media.
No, it's not.
Normally, yeah.
No.
Which is a bit of a problem as well, but this will
answer some questions. And even the demonstrations, which are quite big in New Zealand, and they're not even getting covered at all by
No, in actual fact, who was the cartoonist who got fired from the Herald for making what was viewed as an anti-Israeli...
Oh, really?
Malcolm Evan? No. I can't remember anyway. Yeah.
Right.
Because there's a lot of pressure put on by the Israeli government or someone about this cartoon he'd made.
Yeah. There's a strong Zionist lobby throughout the Western world.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I haven't got time to look that up. Time to go. Thank you for coming in, Julian Marie.
Thank you very much for having me, Aaron, and thank your listeners for listening.
Okay.
And I hope to see them on Wednesday night at the old school.
7 o'clock, folks. Thanks for coming in.
Aaron and Julian mentioned the regular demonstrations that are taking place or vigils. So there's regularly one from 1 till 2 in Garden Place, Hamilton, every Saturday. So... if you happen to be in Hamilton midday on Saturday, you might like to join in that or even make a special trip there. Fits in well with the bus times, actually. The 11:30 bus gets there in good time for it, and the 3 o'clock bus comes back allowing time for lunch there. So anyway, we've got a whole load of stuff to do this evening and probably not going to manage to cover it all. Hoping to fit in most of the interview that Aaron did with Oliver McLeod talking about the geology of Karioi. Well, not just Karioi, but covers quite a big surrounding area as well. So let's have the top of the hour items at 12 minutes to the top of the hour.
This week at the Harvey Hotel, Tuesday, trivia night, $10 third special and $20 muscle pot. Wednesday, pizza special, 20% off any pizza 5 plate. Thursday, jackpot draw of $1,100, meat raffle, burger and beer for $30. $10 mojitos, pina coladas, Thursday, Friday. Friday, happy hour, 4 to 7, Saturday, Sunday, brunch, 9 to 2. Don't forget we are closed on Monday, just rule. Here you go. We look forward to welcoming you and yours for a great time in Raglan at the Harvey Hotel.
Starting a landscaping project? project or just need ideas, come and see us at Raglan Landscape Supplies. We have all the landscaping products you need, from stones to sleepers, sand to bark, drainage meters to builder's mix, pavers to compost. We even have a plant nursery. We deliver to your door. We have free customer loan trailers. We also hire out a post-hole borer, concrete mixer, compactor and water blaster.
Please check out our website, www.raglanlandscapesupplies.co.nz.
We are at 140 Tomato Road. Look for the big green wheelbarrow or ring 825 0577.
Raglan Community Radio supports the Code of Broadcasting Practice for the broadcasts of its radio programs. If you hear something you find offensive or intentionally misleading on our station, you have the right to complain. A formal complaint about a specific program or incident must be made within 20 days of broadcast of that program to Raglan Community Radio, PO Box 126, Raglan.
Raglan Community Radio.
This is where you're listening to Raglan Talking to Raglan at 10 to 7. And coming up a week on Saturday is a book launch, and Aaron talked to Olive MacLeod about it.
Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Dr. Olive MacLeod. Good morning.
Good morning. Kia ora, Aaron.
So we're not talking medicine today. You're a doctor of...
Doctor of rocks.
A rock doctor. Yeah. Cool. Last time we spoke to you was 2020, you reminded me.
Yes.
And you're
yes.
in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign to do a geological survey, basically, of Mount Kareoi and the surrounding area.
Yes.
And given that I'm sitting here now, folks, you should see me. I've got a big map next to me here, and I've got the book with all the information on the other side of me. So that was obviously a success because you've produced the goods. Did you get how much... the Kickstarter campaign was a success?
Yeah, thankfully it was a success. And yeah. There was about 15K raised.
Okay.
And that was enough to really kickstart all of the mapping work. And I think it was the first crowdfunded geology project ever done in New Zealand.
Doesn't surprise me because there's a real strong identity in this area, like in the community. So, yeah, there's a bit of power in that. 15,000 doesn't sound like that much, though. Like, you haven't been working full-time for the last 4 years, I imagine.
No. Well, so how that worked is that was the seed fund.
Yeah.
And recently that money was spent. A lot of it was kept aside right till the very end for printing the book.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
all of the map print production. It's quite a detailed process to print books, and all of it was printed in New Zealand as well. That was something I really wanted to do.
Yeah. And that was part of the deal with the Kickstarter, was the people who funded you were going to get a map and book.
And actually, so a lot of those books were sent out earlier this week.
Yes.
So it's really all just happening now after it's been, almost 4 years.
Yeah. So that naturally, that's how it worked. Were there, was it just one level? Sometimes there's different levels of funding, like people who want to give more can give more. And
I created all of these different... reward tiers, and it was, get a copy of the map or the map in the book, or like some art prints of from a scanning electron microscope, or I even offered, lectures, like I'll come and give a lecture to any audience you want and that sort of thing.
So my wife and I, we must have been at the bottom tier, was it? We've got the book and the map.
Well, the map... A copy of the map in the book was sort of like the main level.
We won't call it bottom, we'll call it the standard.
Yeah, the essential.
It is essential, isn't it? Because why would you do it otherwise? and then after that was some artwork. People could get some artwork.
Yeah, get some artwork. So I was I went to Victoria University a couple of years ago and took all these pictures of crystals from the mountain.
Yeah, okay.
And on the electron microscope and printed them out. And they've got a real artistic quality.
Really beautiful. Like how microscopic are we talking?
Down the total field of view would be sort of 1 millimeter or maybe a couple millimeters at most.
Right.
Yeah, fit between different photos. They're not even photos. They're backscattered energy, which our brain interprets as a picture at the end. That's... So they're amazing, and you can see all these sort of growth rings in the crystals, like tree rings.
Really?
Yeah. And some of these will be on display soon.
So that's, if it's crystals, it's not volcanic?
So lava flows, magmas,
yeah,
contain crystals. So as liquid cools down, it crystallizes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The mantle's made out of crystals. The mantle is crystalline. Lavas or magmas represent melted mantle.
Yeah.
And then as it cools down, the crystals start to form again, and then eventually they erupt. And
you talked about growth rings as if it happened over a...
Yeah.
The growth is...
Because magma chambers on volcanoes are pretty complicated.
Mm.
You have a crystal which forms, and then maybe the magma starts to heat up again, and the crystal might melt a little bit, and then it regrows. And it, on Karioi, the crystals can have 100 growth rings on them. So they've been growing for a very long time.
Wow.
Prior to eruption.
I can see why you've got fascinated by this sort of stuff, haven't you? Is that why you started studying it and got through to having a PhD and you've kept going?
Absolutely. I just, the fascination kind of never stopped. And there didn't seem to be many people studying it either.
Yeah, okay. So in generally or just this area?
Just in this particular region. So Pirongia was the PhD site, and you know, Kakapuku as well out there.
Yep.
And then Karioi kind of followed on.
Mm.
And in some ways it's the superior map subject because you have all these coastal cliffs where you could see all the rock layers.
Ah, yeah, so it's exposed.
And the sea keeps on creating these fresh exposures.
Yeah. And that was also from a different era. Well, you used the way a geologist uses the word era would be the way I use it, but they're different times, aren't they, each eruption?
Yeah, there's. You could see it as Karioi, which is a stratovolcano, or it was a stratovolcano. It's a collection of layers of eruption deposits. Some of them could be lava flows, ash deposits, sort of collapse deposits, you know, as the mountains fallen down, and all of that is preserved as layers, and you can see them in the cliffs and then work out what happened 2.5 million years ago from that.
Yeah. Now, I realise we didn't go back. I want to go back to the Kickstarter.
Mm.
Some people could get a private lecture. Did people take that option?
Yeah, there's a handful of people around the world.
Right.
And
that was that surprising that it was people, it surprises me that it was people out of the area.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to figure out how to give a private lecture in Hawaii and Canada. I don't really know how to do that. I'd probably be online, but and some were like university professors who they said, "Oh, you just present online to our class, you know."
Mm.
And so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. It's And as you said, that was no one's done this before with a Kickstarter.
As far as I'm aware, I haven't, particularly in New Zealand. I don't think anyone's had to do it before.
Is that a comment on funding levels for research these days in this country?
It must be. But one of the things which was a beautiful consequence of kickstarting the work and the way it did was that it maintained degree of independence.
Yeah.
And it also, as it turned out, it insulated me from a lot of the other issues that came up with universities and GNS, and that there's been these huge funding issues since this happened. So
not just in the last, not just with this current government, I presume, but also previous one as well.
Yeah, so since 4 years ago, it's actually geoscience has got hammered. It's a great pun, but it's got hammered even more. And it's
a science pun.
And so whereas this work, which was community supported in the first instance, has kind of been able to survive the whole process, which is pretty special.
Interesting. You'd think understanding geology in New Zealand was fairly important, given how live we still are in terms of, you know, the physical construction of the land.
Yeah, and it is definitely important. Volcanology has always been a bit of a funny subject that is a bit detached from the economy, and a lot of scientists who have been in volcanology over the last couple hundred years, I mean, sometimes there's no money at all in it.
But I've been, like, in my adult life, there's been eruptions at Ruapehu.
Yeah.
So it's not like, it's all within living memory that it's been happening. They weren't, like, hugely disastrous, but they were consequential. They were economically consequential.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've cottoned on to it now. But there's still an element of the research side of volcanology, which is, you know, people living in little shacks on the side of mountains and in Latin America or Africa or in North America, you know, where you've just got people doing it for love of it, monitoring volcanoes. It happens all over the world. New Zealand's one of the better countries for supporting scientists.
Okay, like okay, fair enough. So did you, was there like a lot of volunteer labour in this project, Oliver?
I'd say labour led by passion and interest. So, I mean, some people I'd give a shout out to, like Duncan Mackay, Karioi Project.
Yeah.
He was absolutely awesome in the field supporting me, clambering up and down cliffs. And
actually, those guys know their way around the mountains. So, yeah.
I was actually relying quite a lot on his knowledge of the trap lines to do some parts of the mapping. And there have been many other volunteers who've assisted in different ways throughout this project. They're all listed in the front acknowledgements page of the book.
Yeah, it was quite a long list.
And
I saw
hundreds.
Yeah,
and it's just I'm just really thankful. We wouldn't have got the map finished without all of that support.
Yeah, and also you probably worked more hours than the $15,000.
Yes.
This is what I was
absolutely
too.
So, yeah, absolutely. There must have been thousands of hours of combined field work and then office work as well. Getting the map ready was just sometimes, you know, there were many all-nighters done for years to get it finished.
Well, you're young enough to want to do that sort of thing, I think. I mean, hobby probably belittles it a bit, but there's like a personal, a personal love for you, I guess, to do this sort of stuff.
It was a personal love for the maunga.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot has changed for me. Like, I've had two children since beginning this.
Okay.
Since
you might not be doing this sort of project again if you've got two kids.
I think my focus is shifting now, but it's going to be nice to take my son and daughter out to see Karioi one day.
Yeah.
And but life has massively changed. Like, a lot has happened since 2020.
Yeah, not just for you, for everybody.
For everyone.
Yeah, that is very true. So I want to talk about, like, the history. Actually, we'll go into the geological history in a minute. You presumably have a day job.
Yes, I've got a day job. And like all things, you know, any work I do is a blend of many different things, but so I work at the Waikato Regional Council now, and I started that in late 2022.
Yeah.
And my role is basically to find linkages between traditional Māori knowledge, Mātauranga Māori, and environmental sciences. And that role actually emerged from this project, which also essentially involved a meeting of two different forms of knowledge, right? To understand how Karioi formed its environmental and cultural significance. And that's what I'm doing now. And Regional Council actually supports, you know, the outreach that's involved with the Karioi map and the book launch and everything else.
That's often what happens when you get the chance to pursue your passions. Like, it can't not bleed over. You can't not become useful to somebody with the knowledge you gain and the experience you gain. So, right. Yeah, that's nice to hear. So, all right, so let's talk history, because, as I said to you off the air, I presume at one point there was no mountain. There was maybe a sea floor, or I don't know, I've got no clues. What was here before magma started coming out of the earth at this location?
Okay, so...
And when was that?
Okay, so let's start about 2.6 million years ago.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of the Pleistocene.
Yeah.
And around that time, the sea was about, you know, 15 to 20 kilometers offshore of where it is now.
Okay, yeah.
So this was a nice lowland area. Whangaroa and Aotea was a lowland a lowland area with forested valleys.
Yeah.
And we actually managed to recover a tree stump from that. That's 2.6 million years.
Wow, really? You found this while you were...
Yeah, and it's perfectly preserved. And it was buried beneath one of the oldest lava flows that occurred 2.6 million years ago from the Bridal Veil Falls area.
So where is the stump now?
It's going to be displayed in the exhibition.
Okay, awesome.
In September.
Wow.
So everyone's going to be able to see these trees.
Mm.
Those are the trees that were growing in the landscape. So it was a sandstone, eroded sandstone landscape, about 30 million year old rocks. You had streams flowing through. You had, mostly covered in forest. And then there were these series of eruptions which began out of nowhere.
Yeah, seemingly. Well, geologically you can tell that there must be a hot spot or something, is there? Because there's a line of activity through Porongia and out the other side.
Yeah, so there's in a sense, there's a hot spot in that. We think that about 2.6 million years ago, the Pacific Plate, which was subducting under this part of the North Island, had actually ripped. And it ripped in a northwest-southeast direction, and magma started to come up along that tear and produce these a line of volcanoes, which are Te Kawa, Kakepuku, Pirongia, and then out to Kariwa.
Oh, okay, so it's not a spot, it's a line.
It's a line.
A tear, okay.
About 65 kilometres long.
Yeah.
And so Kariwa is at the edge of that tear, and because it's at the above the edge of the tear, the magma was quite dispersed because you've got the plate sort of ripping apart fully at the edge of the tear, and then magma came up in this big sort of just this widely dispersed area. And so there were all these eruptions in this local area which began. Okay. One of the earliest was the Bridal Veil Falls or Wairanga eruption. Lava flow went into a valley, it pondered in the valley, got to about 30 metres thick, and it buried this entire forest, which when we go back now, we can actually find the tree stumps exposed beneath the lava flow.
Right.
With bark, tree bark still attached.
So is that around under the waterfall itself or just along that whole wall?
It's along the wall. At the waterfall, I don't think you can see the trees, but you can see there's a burnt layer of soil beneath the lava flow.
Yeah.
So it's all preserved quite remarkably. And then there were, after that eruption, there were just many others. Taranaki Point, some eruptions near the modern-day Te Toto Gorge, some near Naranui Beach. And these little scoria cones, like the ones you'd see in Auckland, and tuff rings, kind of like the Orake Basin in Auckland, like sort of an explosion crater with a gently dipping ash ring around it. That's what the landscape transformed into, and it would have been, very damaging to all the forest that was there, redirected all the streams. The landscape would have looked quite barren, quite rocky, quite ash-covered, dusty.
Yeah.
And then from that, about 2.58 million years ago, so just not long after, essentially, Kariwa started to form as a stratovolcano, as a central volcano within this mass of messy scoria cones and tuff rings. The magma sort of consolidated into one area and started to build the central volcano.
And that is in the location where we roughly think the center is now of the mountain?
Yeah, okay. Roughly there.
Okay.
And the way that this has been reconstructed is by going to the coastal outcrops of Kariwa and looking at the succession of rock layers.
So you can see where you can distinguish each lava flow.
Exactly.
And ash. I guess there's layers of ash and layers of lava and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And so there were some fairly big explosions. One of the first lavas that came out in the Kariwa area was this rock or lava type called Ankeramite, with these very big crystals of clinopyroxene. And you can find these lava flows as boulders, in Manu Bay, Whale Bay.
Those big round
yep.
boulders that where there's no sand, it's just boulders.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
And from there, it kind of just kept growing. And there was about 20 lava flows erupted in close succession, so building up a cone that would have looked like Rangitoto Island.
Okay, so not as steep as it currently is.
Not as steep, so yeah. quite a gently dipping, a shield-like volcanic structure. And then over the next 100,000 years or so, Kariwoi transitioned into a steeper stratovolcano.
So there's just constant eruptions over the millennia, do we say millennia? What do I say? Yeah. If thousands of years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was constant eruptions with some pauses in between, and also as we now know happens in other stratovolcanoes like Taranaki or Mount St. Helens, Kariwoi would get too steep and then it would collapse under gravity. And so one of those collapses flowed north towards where the Wainui Reserve is. All of that land is a debris avalanche.
So so that's what happened. When you say a mountain collapses, it gets too steep.
And
it just all falls downhill till it comes to a rest at some point.
Yeah, and it could take only a couple of minutes for the whole thing to fall down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Taranaki's done that many times.
That'll be pretty frightening.
Yeah, it would be really noisy. The earth would be rumbling.
So how far away would people feel the rumble?
I think you could probably feel it, probably even Auckland area. Okay. I mean, it'd be a long way away.
So people think there was an earthquake or something. Yeah.
It would register as an earthquake.
Yeah.
And so Taranaki and Ruropehu, they've done this, the same process, collapsing. It's just every stratovolcano in the world essentially does that.
Mm.
So grow, and then all regrow. So more magma is erupted, the volcano rebuilds.
Yeah.
And then if it gets too steep, it collapses again. Kariwoi did it twice. There were two big collapses.
So did it used to be taller?
Yeah, it was definitely taller. I mean, in the sense of the mountain would have probably reached over 1,000 metres, but not. It wasn't.
That's almost double.
Well, it's 756 metres now.
Oh, is it? For some reason, I thought it was 500. I don't know why I think that. I have to wipe that from my brain. So 700 and...
Yeah, 756 metres is the summit trig now.
Okay.
So conservatively, you could say, maybe 1,100 metres. We can't rule out that it was taller, but the evidence from the surrounding landscape, the ring plane, that we'd call it, doesn't seem to support it being a really, really tall cone. As well as the footprint of the mountain itself, it's not that big. So
if it had been taller, there would have been more stuff to fall down and it would have had to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Basically.
In contrast to, Mount Pirongia, which is almost 13 kilometres wide at its base, and that could have supported a very tall mountain. We just don't know. So
okay,
conservatively, I thought Pirongia, 1,350 metres tall.
Yeah.
Kariwoi, maybe just over 1,000. But, because Kariwoi had two collapses during its active volcanic lifespan, it may have been taller, and maybe the deposits are offshore and now underwater.
Okay, so you haven't explored the seafloor or the sea itself.
I haven't been out there myself, but as you'll see in one of the first figures in the book, the Kariwoi book, there is a map which shows some unusual volcanic features offshore towards Kārewa or Gannet Island.
Yeah.
One of the things, when I reviewed the aeromagnetic survey, which was done, looking for black sand, this was done in 2008,
yep.
Sinosteel.
Yeah.
I looked at their data and they had uncovered about 12 volcanoes that are hidden within about 10 kilometres west offshore of Kariwoi.
So they're all under the sandy floor or whatever the sea floor is, I don't actually know.
They'll be buried by sand or just other sediment. They're in, 30 metres of water, more or less. And that's kind of significant because it's not common in New Zealand for us to actually discover new volcanoes anymore. I mean, maybe every couple of years there might be a small one found.
So did they tell anyone or did no one really think about it until you got the data?
I don't think anyone thought about it. I think they were
just looking for iron sand, obviously,
which is magnetic as well. And yeah. Basaltic rocks, volcanic rocks, are also magnetic. So they were probably ignoring the volcanic rocks, whereas I was exclusively looking for those.
They probably thought it was a nuisance.
Just, exactly.
Yeah, messing up the data. Had to work harder. Yeah. Okay, so we've got... When did all the... Are we at the point where we can say that when the eruptions all stopped in the story? Have we reached that point?
Well, we can get there. So the eruptive activity at Kariwoi began about 2.58 million years ago and ended about 2.4 million years ago.
Okay.
So let's just say it's about 180,000 years of volcanic activity on the main volcano.
Yeah.
The volcanism continued from small scoria cones, such as, you know, Maunga Tawhiri, Ohio Popoko.
See, I didn't know, like, Maunga Tawhiri Road is on. That's a volcano.
Yeah.
It's 100%. Not just a hill or a from other sources. In fact, what you said historically, there was quite it was lowlands out here, so there wouldn't have been a lot of ridges.
Yeah, in general, the hills kind of south, immediately south of Raglan and going towards Te Mata, it's all volcanic. They're all small volcanoes.
Right, and including the I know it's not on your map with the Tiuku wind farm, but that area, the wind farm's there because it's up high.
Yeah.
So that's volcanic as well?
Yeah, and if you do the... there's the trail that goes up there. You can actually see red scoria at the top of the, the farm track cuttings and stuff. So the wind farm was built on a lava flow because it's nice and stable rock.
See, now this is the thing. You call that a lava flow, but that's... Like, how did that get there? Because it's the highest point in its area.
Yes, it appears that, and again, we can look at the aeromagnetic data to confirm this, but there was actually a volcano that erupted on top of that mountain range, and most of it's eroded now.
So that's the range that the Divi is on, the Divi crosses?
Yeah, right. Essentially, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, see, that's kind of intriguing. So it didn't come from this side, it came from over there.
That's right. So here's a fascinating stat. Just in the onshore region near Kariwoi, there are more than 50 small volcanic eruption centres alongside the main Kariwoi mountain. So more than 50 separate eruption sites occur just between Whangaroa and the Aotea Harbour.
So on your map, we can see where those are, can we?
Yeah, you could see them on the map, and you could probably count them as well, and you'll get about 50. So I've mapped out the location of every definable eruption centre, so you can look at areas of high magnetic rock where there's been an injection of magma, which is frozen now, and it's now solid basalt plug.
Yep.
Or you could see, in the case of Maunga Tawhiri, you know, they've got an actual hill still preserved. There's also some near Te Mata, there's some really unusual, you know, extremely magnetic features which represent deep explosion craters that could be, you know, hundreds of metres deep, probably were filled with lake sediment at one time. And those are what we call Ma craters. So that's where the magma hit groundwater and it just has this massive explosion and generates a very deep hole. And so,
right, okay. It's pretty violent then.
Pretty violent, but what's amazing as well is that I've got colleagues in the South Island who found similar features in Otago, and if you drill into a Mar crater, sometimes you can find fossils of fish or leaves or insects that are millions of years old. Because those explosion craters fill with water and then preserve fossils beautifully.
Yeah.
So maybe at Te Mata there'll be a feature like that.
Okay. Is there anything where, like, you talk about these kind of plugs and little eruption points, is there anywhere that's like really obviously a cone, a little mini cone or something that you go, oh yeah, that's definitely, like a layperson would go, oh yeah, that's definitely something happening there?
I think on the Raglan side, you've got the Opotoru cone, which is a kind of, it'll be sort of southeast of Naranui Beach. There's a very distinct hill rising up out of the side of Kariwoi. So can you see it there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yep. So on the map. Oh, we're looking at the map. Okay. Yep. Oh, now I'm trying to imagine how to look at that.
So
is that higher? Is that higher around the pink area? Is it lower around all sides of it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so if you're on the right angle, you would see it.
You'll see it rising up out of the otherwise dipping slopes of Kariwai. So that's a very distinct cone. Another would be Houchin's Hill, which is kind of southeast of Te Mata.
Can we say, hold on, I want to interrupt. So is there a road near there or somebody's farm we can say? Was that near Extreme?
It is. It's near. It's Extreme. Extreme Waste is actually on the scoria cone.
On the foot of it.
Yeah.
And that's why it goes up steeply behind it.
Yeah.
And then there's a plateau at the top, which is where our transmitter site is.
Right.
As well as three cell phone towers.
So there you go. Made perfect use of it.
Yeah, and that is. Yes. Yeah, we did. We made good use of it. It was very windy up there, mind you.
Yeah.
Things get blown around.
Yeah,
but,
I bet it is.
Okay. All right. That's cool. So now I know. Whoop. The map's taken off. That's something I know well. I know intimately that area. So stay still, man.
Another one would be, I should mention, you know, Kirikiripu Hill, which is just, which is in Raglan, right?
So, yeah.
As you're driving in, before you get into the town, you'll see there's a hill. It's got a pass site on the top. That's Kirikiripu, and that's an ancient volcano as well. And Kirikiripu is incredible, maybe unique in New Zealand in the sense of about 70% of the volume of Kirikiripu's lavas are filled with chunks of the Earth's mantle, which is this bright green crystalline stuff made of olivine. So this lava has brought chunks of the mantle to the surface. So half the lava flow is shining with this green crystalline material.
Is it still molten, or is it?
It's all solidified now.
But when it came up, the bits that came up, the bits of the mantle, that was still molten.
Well, believe it or not, so the mantle is largely crystalline, right? And we mentioned this earlier, is the mantle is not really molten. It's crystal material, which then has to melt to form a magma.
Yeah.
So these lavas, which were molten, have carried essentially cold chunks of the mantle up from maybe, you know, 50 plus kilometres down.
So the mantle is a large, what they refer to, a large part of just inside the Earth. You've got the core,
yeah,
which, and that's molten.
Yeah.
And then you've got the mantle outside of that.
Well, the core is solid.
Okay.
Because it's under so much pressure.
Okay, so that it can't be anything else.
Yeah.
So where does the molten stuff come from then?
So that's actually the key question, right, is magma is not, it's not, the centre of the Earth isn't just sloshing around with magma. It's all under high pressure. It's all crystalline. The reason that we get a magma forming, and particularly in this context, is that subduction has been occurring. The Pacific Plate goes down. The Pacific Plate, which is oceanic crust, is full of water.
Yeah.
That water is being pushed into the mantle. When that water is released via dehydration, it chemically alters the mantle above it.
Yeah.
And makes it susceptible to melting at a lower temperature.
Okay.
So water is the secret ingredient here.
Yeah.
And then that mantle material, which has been flushed by seawater, essentially, it then is able to rise up as a melt. And they're very small volumes of this that occur. So you only need a little bit, and then it reaches up, hits the base of the crust, maybe crystallizes a bit, and then it rises up and it might form a volcano.
Okay, so now I want to ask about places like Hawaii.
Okay.
Where, as far as I know, that's in the middle somewhere of a plate, and you can see when you look on a map, you can clearly see the line of cones. So how did water get... What's going on there? Is that the same? Is the same thing happening? Because it's not near an earthquake zone, is it?
No, right. So there's no subduction zone in the middle of the Pacific Plate. So how does that happen? That is a classic hotspot.
Okay.
The other way you can get magma coming up is a huge decompression or upwelling zone from the asthenosphere, the deeper mantle.
Yeah.
And it comes up as a big blob, and you've got a plate that's slowly moving over the top of that blob. Like the Pacific Plate, because it's subducting, right, elsewhere.
Yeah.
So it's always moving. And that's how you get a hotspot chain like Hawaii, like Tahiti. And that's a very different process.
But is there water getting down there, or is it not anything to do with water?
It's sort of an anhydrous process. Water is not really a factor there.
Okay.
Yep. And hotspots are a little bit harder to understand. So, that, but there are other mental dynamics at play that create hotspots. And this is a perfect point to make, because this brings us to the most unusual thing about Kariyoi. The reason I probably wanted to map in the first place is at Kariyoi and the surrounding small volcanoes, we find two types of magma have been erupted. Subduction type magma.
Yeah.
Which is formed by fluxing of water through the mantle.
Yeah.
And then we have intraplate type magma, which is not related to that process.
So that's more like Hawaii.
Hawaiian style. We have both here. This is one of a few places in the entire world where that's ever occurred.
Right.
It's a very, very unusual phenomena, possibly related to the tearing of the Pacific plates, where you get the best of both worlds. You get some subduction, but you're also getting magma coming up like a hot spot from underneath and rising through the tear.
So it's pretty unique.
It's very unique, and it's genuinely hard to explain how that happened.
I know you've been working with experts in Japan.
Yeah.
And to my mind, that's a very similar kind of country geologically. Do they have things like that over there?
Japan has, it's sort of like subduction zone central. So Japanese scientists and New Zealand scientists often work together. And I mean, shout out to Chris Conway, who's a co-author on this book. Chris actually mapped Mount Ruapehu during his PhD, which is pretty amazing. And Chris provided the age dating for this project with Osamu Shizuka, who's his mentor in the research space. And Japan has a lot of subduction-related volcanism. It also has intraplate volcanism. To the best of my ability, I don't think that they overlap in the as closely as it does here.
Yeah.
But Japan definitely has both types of volcanism. You've got intraplate and subduction related going on in the same island setting.
Yeah.
What's really kind of unusual at Kariyoi is how they're in the exact same place erupting from the same volcano.
Yeah.
And but that's not to say that this won't be uncovered elsewhere in the world. But at this point, you know, I've done a...
Would we have not known until you did this?
This has been known for some time. And, you know, again, I give thanks to my other co-author, Roger Briggs. So Roger was a long-time member of the Earth Science Department, University of Waikato. He was really the one who uncovered that story.
Right, okay.
And he was abseiling down Te Tauira Gorge before I was born, looking for this stuff. Yeah, and yeah. And a lot of this work reflects that kind of foundation that he built through his own research, and I've gone in and added all the details and connected the dots on the map. But this has been known for some time. One of the objectives of mapping was to figure out exactly where the subduction-type rocks and the intraplate rocks occur, because on Kariyoi itself, there was a lot of uncertainty. As soon as you get away from the coast, where it's kind of obvious,
yeah,
the upper mountain, it's really hard to see the rocks. So you've got to walk everywhere and figure out how it all fits together. How does the top of the mountain relate to what you see on the coast?
So what are you actually doing up there? I mean, are you digging things? Do you have devices like ultrasound devices or something like that? I'm pulling words out of the back of my head here.
No, it's very, very simple. I go up with a camera, a compass, a GPS. I take notes on the rocks I find. So maybe take a small rock sample with the rock hammer, check the texture. If it's a really fresh sample, maybe I do a chemical analysis on it. But basically, I'm just trying to document which rocks occur where.
Mm.
And that's not high-tech stuff. That's just a lot of...
A lot of hiking, leg work.
Yeah.
So you've been all over the mountain then?
Been most places. There's still some spots that, you know, I never went to, but...
Would it have been possible, like the Kariyoi project a few years before you started, they put tracks all through for for their work.
Yeah.
That must have been hugely helpful.
Yeah, and actually, all of the tracks from the Kariu project are shown on the on this map.
Oh, okay.
So that it show that, and that helps to inform, kind of give the reader an idea of where I've actually walked. So
yeah,
done the tracks, but then there's a lot of off track stuff, getting into valleys, various ridge lines and places that wouldn't make sense to go from a, you know, trapping perspective.
Yeah.
A lot. There were many field trips I did. You know, you walk up a valley for 13 hours and you find no rocks. And so you've got to be very.
And we're just coming up to the bottom of the hour, so there's another 10 minutes or so of that interview to go. So if you want to listen to it before I manage to play the rest of it, you might like to look at our website, raglanradio.com. And if you go down to last Thursday, you'll find the title, Kariu Georgiou Book Launch, and you can hear the whole thing. So if you have been, thanks for listening to Raglan Talking to Raglan. If you haven't, you're probably waiting for the music to start, and it's just turned 7:30 now. So you might manage to join me next week, 6-ish, till 7:30-ish, here on Raglan Community Radio, here around your Whangaroa, and the computer has lined up Lucid 3 West as the next track that it's going to play. So here goes.
The bells make them leave, run away.